And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us for yet another of my favorite parts of the show, our interview. And if you've been listening to the Daily Dots and even the last couple of weeks of the show, you know that we're really paying attention to Fed policy and what the Fed governors have to say, because we find ourselves in a very interesting situation, and one that I spoke to this guest about over a year ago, and I've spoke to some other guests about over a year ago, and here we are. And so at the realization that we are here finally, or what I think is here, I just thought, you know what, there's no other person that I'd rather have on to have this discussion about the Federal Reserve other than my good friend, Mr. Rudy Havenstein. Rudy, welcome back to the show, and I couldn't be more happy you are here at this time on this day.
Well, thank you. It's glad to be back. Great to see you.
You've had some you've had some really some softballs thrown at you here, some easy fodder thrown at you from the Fed recently, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, every day it's, you know, so I'm kind of sick of it, actually. It's been,
I am too. Somebody reposted an interview that you put up a while back. It was, in my opinion, it was when Real Vision was really cranking out their best stuff. And it was the Alan Boyce interview.
Oh, yeah. That was 2016. That's one of my favorites. Yeah. It's out there today. Yeah. I reposted it.
Eerie how dead on that was, and it's so interesting to think back at that time, because guys like you and me were having these conversations at that time and saying, listen, if they continue down this path, which they seem hell-bent on doing, we're going to find ourselves painted into a corner. Look, one of the first questions I had for you, and for our listening audience, Rudy is a fascinating character to me because he has not spent his life in finance. And that's one of the things that attracts me to him and to other people that go down this rabbit hole of economics and finance and become very educated on it. Because I think the fact that they haven't been plugged in to the internal part of the financial system gives them a unique purview. And they're not weighted down with as much nonsensical dogma. And so anyway, I didn't want to cut you off, Rudy, but first and foremost, when we're looking at the setup today, what are your thoughts? Do you think that we are in that final that point where they have painted themselves into a corner? And then just where do you assess where we're at in this money printing, you know, central bank driven world right now?
Well, I think I don't think we're near, you know, Armageddon or anything like that, but I have noticed that they've started monkeying with the data again. Mm-hmm. You know, the CPI they messed with again with healthcare. There's a particular series that I've been following for years, which is now lately several other people have noticed it on Twitter, but I've been on this forever, and it's like the top 1%, you know, share of net worth, you know, and they also do like the top 0.1. They do you know, the 90th to 99th, they do the 50th to 90th, and then they do the bottom 50th. So that's why when I comment on it, it's based on those rankings, because that's how the Fed does it. And so these are Fed numbers, not BLS numbers. And sometime in the last few months, they massively changed the data. I've even have some examples out there using archive.org where they actually, the charts changed. And they go back, they retroactively altered the data. And it's explained as, updates to their, distributional financial accounts models. So these are models. And I mean, that's all I could find. I mean, I didn't go read the paper on what exactly they did, but basically what they did was they tried to make horrible numbers look a little better. In other words, they tried to make wealth inequality, look less bad. And maybe the data they were using for years is the model they used for years. Cause I'm not even gonna say the data, maybe the model they used for years was wrong and the new model is closer to the truth, but I doubt it, because every single time the government changes how they formulate something, particularly with CPI, it's always to make things look rosier from the government point of view, not from the guy in the supermarket's point of view.
No, couldn't agree.
I'll give you one example. There's a series they do, which I've posted, where they do corporate equities and mutual fund shares by wealth percentile group. So this isn't net worth. This is corporate equities and mutual fund shares. So in last year, as of like October, they had the top 1% having 53.8% of all corporate equities and mutual fund shares, 53.8. If you go on now to that data series, they've dropped it to 44.7%. So that's a 9%, almost 10% drop. And that's significant. And then they retroactively went back and changed all the old data. In fact, I had a guy the other day who was like really giving me a hard time because of my top 1% chart. And he was looking at the new one and also a post I had made like a couple years ago, and apparently. And they look quite different. The difference in the charts is it looks like the share of the 1% actually went up sooner with their new models and look like it's just been flat during this wacky period of massive QE and something. Whereas the older version, it was like a 45-degree angle up of the 1%. And it looked really bad. And I could see someone in the BLA or someone at the Fed saying, we got to change that chart. And based on their history, I just think, you know, Peter Stange had a great quote today. God, let me find it because it's worth repeating and then I'll be quiet. Let's see. Just give me 1 second to look this up because I retweeted it. He's an economist, PhD, I guess, which believe me, there's several PhD economists that actually follow me and kind of like me, I think. So when I bash the PhDs, it's just the bad ones. Oh, yeah, this is great. The statistics aren't designed to inform. They're designed to hide the truth. There you go.
Well, I put out a tweet that I just said, you know, economic nirvana is just a few hedonic adjustments away, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And they'll just keep – one of the things – And I have known this, and if there's anybody listening that knows otherwise, I would be happy for you to shoot me a DM or whatever, because, you know, at the end of the day, we just want to get it right. I don't believe that they've ever made, that I'm aware of, a rejiggering, if you will, of any data set where it didn't come out less inflationary, right? Where at right. the very least, right now you're talking about, you know, wealth inequality and, you know, you can torture the numbers enough to make them say anything you want. And one of the things that we've been looking at and speaking to, and I'm glad you brought this up, because when I look, you and I have both lived through periods of times where the economy was growing at a legitimate 4 to 4.5%. For those of you that haven't, it doesn't feel like this, right? So one of the things we've been looking at, and you know, Rudy, I'm not a PhD economist, so I don't, you know, I can't go out and prove this. It's more of an Occam's razor observation for me that when I look at the data and I look at all the economic information and, you know, all the stuff that we can get our hands on, a lot of it does not make sense. But if I look at it through the lens of inflation being understated, so let's say add 150 to 250 bips to the inflation rate, and I have no idea if that's right. I'm just saying. If you then add 150 to 250 bips to the inflation rate, everything makes a lot more sense, right? You'd look at a real growth rate, maybe between 1.5 to 2, right? You'd look at, you know, it makes a lot more sense. And again, I can't prove it. But when I look at the world, I sit there and I go, yeah, look, all this stuff is disjointed. You know, for instance, look at the parts of the economy that aren't participating at all. And yet at the same time, we're rolling at 4.5% growth. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think there's something to that? Would you agree? Do you think inflation – and I don't know, Rudy, if it is when I say it's understated, I'm not even saying it. I think it's necessarily something that they've done in the past couple years. But I think it may have, you know, it may be the result of all of these hedonic adjustments over time. It may have something to do with the pace at which this inflation came on. That sticks out to me like a sore thumb. Like it's like one of those child's games, right? Like which of these things doesn't fit? The inflation rate just doesn't fit here.
No, I mean, for 10 years, you know, when I got on Twitter in 2013, I mean, for the next 8 or 9 years, they told us there was no inflation and we need more inflation every day. And in fact, there was a Hilsenrath article in 2015 in the Wall Street Journal where, and this is true all over. Look at any article or anything now that says, why are you people complaining? You know, that everything is wonderful. Read the comments. Oh, yeah. So Hilsenrath had this article with along those lines back in 2015, when I think the CPI was either 0.17% or even negative some months in 2015. Okay. And you read the comments. These are from registered Wall Street Journal subscribers, and they are, what are you talking? Everyone's screaming at him. I mean, I have it out there.
Yeah.
I posted it. And this is almost 10 years ago when supposedly we were under a period of zero inflation. I think hedonics is enormous, because what they do is they say, what hedonics does is it allows them to say with a straight face that things that go up in price go down in price. And that's wonderful in PhD land, but that has absolutely no relation to, you know, the real world, as far as I can see, for most people. There's a Robert Shiller paper from 20 years ago about how economists and non-economists view inflation extremely differently, mm-hmm. totally differently. I think you're totally right. I mean, I read a lot of comments. I just like I did before the GFC, you know, or Great Depression too, I like to call it. But, you know, while everyone like Mark Zandi or people like that are saying, hey, everything's great, you look at comments from real people. I mean, this is pre-bot era, and they're not okay. Now, they're okay for everybody on CNBC. Sure. And I think that's all these people hang out with. I mean, Janet Yellen lives next door to Ben Bernanke, according to one article that I posted. And so this, you know, it's, and Donald Cohn, who's another, you know, been a lifer in the, you know, off and on the Fed for years. He lives in the same neighborhood, according. And anything I say here, someone could say, hey, where's that link? And I'll send it to you. But it's, they're in a bubble. They're absurd. You know, I mean, you know, Scott Wapner turns to, you know, Barry Sternlicht, or, well, not Barry Sternlicht. He's having a little rough time right now, but they turn to anybody on their panels. They're all, they've been killing it. They've had a, you know, a bull market since March 2009. So no, I think you're totally right. I think the CPI is grossly understated. I think hedonics is a huge part of it. I mean, they said for 25 years that car prices didn't
go up. I was just going to bring this up because for we've been talking about this a lot. And I want to run this analogy by you because I think it's so, you know, I love it when you catch flack, just because you are really, and I'm not trying to shine you on here. You're really, I know what your intention is. You're trying to educate people to what's actually going on, right?
Yeah.
And I think you're doing a great job of it. And I think a great analogy to help people understand this is what you're bringing up about cars. And I think that there is an element that's intentional. I also think it's also kind of a product of just mission drift, if you will. Meaning, I think if you look at scenarios, like, you know, you're always going to get the Fed purists that come back and go, oh, hedonic adjustments are important and you don't know what you're talking about. And I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. For instance, I think a good hedonic adjustment would be one that's applied to phone costs, right? Let's go back to 1980 and look what the average family is spending on phones. Okay, I guarantee you it's exponentially higher today, right? But all of that increase should not be inflation, because look what we get, what the kind of use we get out of our phones now, right? I mean, you know, the $300 or $400 phone bill today is, it is cheaper than the $15 or $20 phone bill 40 years ago, you know, in terms of what it allows us to do. But when you take that same ideology or that same idea to vehicles, right? Cars today don't do their job any better than cars did 40 years ago. And they last a little longer, right? But what is the utility, right? What is the economic utility? It's not massaging seats. It's not sunroofs. It's not even 15-speaker car stereos, right? What is it? It gets you from point A to point B. So that compare, right, hedonically, and you cited this. I think I learned this from you, and I'm forgetting the time frame, but the Fed shows that. They sit there and they made an argument that automobiles didn't increase in price for 25 years.
From the mid-90s.
Right. And you look at them and go, that is nonsense, because that is purely inflation, meaning people have to have a car. The car doesn't do anything for the average worker that it didn't, you know, that it didn't do in the mid-90s.
Well, I mean, but my, you know, people say, oh, the cars are way better, and they are, and so are the TVs, and you know, so are the phones. But the thing is, it doesn't matter if the car can do brain surgery if you can't afford it.
Well, and the economic utility of it, right? Like you think about the time and the money and the productivity that the cell phone added. Massaging seats in a moonroof do not improve my economic productivity. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, applying hedonic adjustments to something like a car or to even, you know, I don't think they do this, but I feel like that's like applying hedonic adjustments to jeans. Right. Like
they do that with shirts. Oh, I have an example from the BLS. They do that with men's shirts.
Okay,
and there's a calculation of, they compare short sleeve to long sleeve, and they compare polyester to cotton. And there's a calculation. You should see the math. I'll send it to you afterwards. It's yes, they do not think like normal people. These are math PhDs. You know, they have physics envy, and they everything's a model, and it has very little to do with the real world. Another thing is the weightings. I haven't gotten into that in a while, but I mean, I think years ago, like garbage collection or something was the same weighting as healthcare or something. I mean, I'm probably exaggerating there, but it's ridiculous. They have these goofy weightings, and then they have substitution, you know, which is the classic, you know, chicken goes up, so you eat hamburgers, right. You know, that kind right. of thing. And that's a quality of life. To some people, that'd be a quality of life. You're stepping down, you know, and even with the phones, you're right. The phone is now like a little computer that sent people to the moon, you know, or more so than years ago. But if you can't, I mean, so the price is now how much is a phone now? $1,000. I have my phones until, you know,
it's almost $2,000. It's almost $2,000.
And yeah, $2,000. So, you know, for most, you know, most people, you know, according to the Social Security Administration, half of people make less than $40,000. So of wage earners, these are people that pay taxes. So they make, so if you're making $40,000, that's the other thing I was going to say. I was thinking about, you know, the other big lie I think is wages are keeping up with inflation. Well, okay. So if you make $40,000, like let's say a median wage earner in America, and you get a 5% raise, that's $2,000 a year. Well, that's one car repair bill. And what if your rent goes up $200 a month? I mean, it sounds nice, and they say it, and no one questions it. This is the thing. No one questions any of this. That chart that they had at the BLS showing flat, car prices were flat, new and used, for about 25 years from the mid-90s. I don't remember a single Fed reporter or financial reporter or anyone ever looking at that and saying, huh, that's kind of weird because car prices have gone way up, you know? And here I am, this lone nut, you know, pointing out the stuff. And years ago when I did that, so some prominent FinTwit guys, you know, Fed shills would come after me, but they don't come after me anymore. And which is, I think people are realizing this. I feel like, you know, it's making a little bit of difference. People are starting to look at these things. Wait a minute. This chart you show, he says, you know, 25 years, there's no inflation in cars. And now, if you look at it lately, the last few years, it's hard to hide because the prices, you know, especially during COVID, went up unrelated to any heat. They couldn't really jigger it with hedonics too much. So that's why you saw the big spike recently. But frankly, car prices have been going up for years. And if you readjusted all the CPI statistics just on the car prices to be what people actually had to pay out of pocket over the years, I imagine CPI would be far, far higher. I mean, CPI is it's all gaslighting. They want to – and of course, CPI is not – just as CPI was not zero in 2015 – you know, I think it's a little bit more. I know it's a little bit more than 3% right now. I mean, everybody. I posted the other day. You know, my auto insurance went up 41%. Same cars, same, no accidents, no nothing. And I had for every guy who replied, well, mine didn't go up, so you're wrong. I had a dozen reply. Mine went up 30%. Mine went up 50%. My homeowners went up, you know, 50%. Mine did that last year. So if the man on the street is on my side, 100% as far as inflation, it's. The cost of living is going way up, and that's why people are upset. You know, I said in 2016, when early 2016, like early in the year, Trump and Sanders are winning states, and everyone's going, wait, the economy is the best economy ever, best economy ever. How are Trumpets? I said, look, Trump and Sanders are presenting an economic narrative that people understand, that people can relate to. It just so back, it's the same thing now. You know, Biden and all his acolytes are coming out every day saying everything's great. And I think it is great for the top, I say 10%, maybe it's 20% are doing great. But the vast majority of people are struggling with inflation. Inflation is, to most people, an extremely bad thing. And but the economists who are running the show here for my entire life, they don't see it that way. They view inflation as a good thing.
Yeah, you know, I was having a conversation. I was picking my boys up from basketball practice the other night, and I was having a conversation with another dad. And it got me to thinking. We were talking about educational costs, and it got me to thinking about all the inputs to educational costs. And again, if people have work out that they've done work on educational costs as an indicator of inflation, I'd love to see it. I could easily be wrong. But what was interesting to me as I started thinking about it, I thought back about two different things. If we think about, like, let's go back to 2005 and let's average the inflation rate, you know, let's sub out the last 2 to 3 years just because, you know, everything that's gone on. But let's look at the inflation rate between, you know, 2005 and 2020. If you look at the Fed data, and I don't know exactly what it is, but I think the Fed would suggest over that period of time that inflation rose, you know, 25-30%. Does that sound about right? Over that 15 years, if you look at their average annual rates of inflation?
Oh, I think, it was running under 2%, I think, a lot of the time. I'd have to look at it again. But yeah, it was subdued.
Yeah, so
using their model.
Right. As they reported it. Now, here's what's interesting.
So say 2%.
Here's what's interesting. When I graduated high school, I went to a private Catholic high school in the Tacoma, Washington area. And when I graduated high school, my parents were paying $8,000 a year for me to go to that high school. My daughter just took the entrance exam to that same high school, and tuition's running $24,000 a year. High school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
My college, when I began in 2000, the same year that I was paying $8,000 for high school, college tuition was $23,000-$24,000 a year. My younger cousin just graduated from that same school. It's now 65. Okay. So I look at the increases from college to high school. They're pretty uniform, about 3x over that period of time, right? How in the world? Then you look at what college costs are as a percentage of people, whether they're paying debt or whether they're paying. That is a significant economic input for the average American family. Okay. If that cost rises 3x in 15 years, how in the world did you average 1.5 to 2% inflation? I mean, you think about the inputs into education. How is that possible?
Because that was their model. They didn't weight it high enough, or they said, "Well, God knows, so you're getting a better education, so it's actually cheaper."
Apparently, they haven't been to a college campus lately.
Yeah. Well, I should also note that when did federal student loan, which is now the biggest asset of the federal government, financial asset, federal student loan debt start to take off? 2008, when they started backing, I think it was 2008, when they started backing the loans. Look at a chart, go to Fred, type Fred, you know, student loans. And it's like 1.7 trillion now, something like that, from I think a few hundred billion, if not less. So once the government starts guaranteeing, I'd have to check those numbers, but I mean, go yourself and look at a student loan chart. The government, the taxpayer is on the hook. Once the government starts guaranteeing the loans, the colleges are free to gouge. And I think they have absolutely gouged. And if you look at the administrators to teacher ratio, I mean, that's skyrocketed, you know, and they're paying these people, you know, a ton of money. And I think it's at a point now where, you know, do you really want to send your kid for 65 or 75 grand a year to a school where they're going to be taught to hate themselves? No. I mean, it's insane. I mean, unless you're going for a science related, a STEM related, or whatever degree. But the problem is, you know, now you've got people with, you know, gender studies degrees that have, I don't know, $200,000 in debt, and if Biden wants to forgive it, when you forgive that, all that means is that we're paying whoever the lender is, the taxpayers are. So you get to pay for your own kid's college tuition, plus you pay for this other person. And then you got the people, you know, and the forgiving the debt, I don't even want to get into that too much because people get so, it's like talking about, you know, Trump or something. They get so enraged, but you know, it really is annoying to people who either didn't go to college, which I think is most Americans, or people who did and paid their own way and worked their way through as I did. Or people who paid, you know, paid their way and didn't take on 200 grand of debt. And
I mean,
it's not my biggest issue, but it's just like it's if you want to tick off more people, just forgive all the debt. And then people get all mad and say, oh, you know, what we gave this, we gave billions to these billionaires. Well, yeah, I rail against that all day, too. So
And I'm with you. And there is real, look, I've been incredibly blessed, and I've been, you know, I've ended up incredibly lucky and blessed. And I, you know, I'll take a little bit of credit for it, but not a lot. And you have too, but at the same time, I will say this, as a guy that had to finance his own way through college and didn't qualify for any college loans because I was in the sweet spot, my parents provided me a wonderful, idyllic childhood. It really was, but we weren't rich.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were kind of stuck in that middle ground. My parents had enough to send me to private school. You know, I lived a wonderful life, but they didn't have enough to just fork out 24 grand a year for me and my sisters to go to college. So we took on, I paid the, you know, probably about 95% of my own school, and I got no discounts, right? Because of my FAFSA was underneath my parents' income. It was enough for me not to get any money, right? But it also meant that I had to pay full freight. And anyway, my wife and I, when we first started out, that student loan was $1,700 a month. And the reason I remember that is because our mortgage was $1,650. So we were paying more in student loans than even our mortgage. And it was painful. And then now, and Rudy, that was off of $24,000 a year college. That's like community college now, you know? So,
well,
go ahead.
Well, you look at Harvard's endowment is something like $60-70 billion. Why is the U.S. taxpayer guaranteeing student loans to go to Harvard? And there's other examples too. Many examples. I don't understand.
Because somebody's making money off it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just ridiculous. Or go look at another fun one to go look at is go look at what happened to student loan balances as soon as they were no longer allowed to be involved in bankruptcy proceedings. Right. They just.
Well, that was Biden voted for that in 2005. That bill.
That
yeah. Why not let them go through bankruptcy?
They did that in the early 90s. I thought Hillary had spearheaded that.
No, I'm pretty sure I think it was in the mid 2000s that the bankruptcy bill, which they may have altered it earlier to be fair, but I think that's where they shut the door on it. I think in extreme circumstances, you can petition a judge, but it's not generally acceptable. I think bankruptcy in America has been a good thing overall. Gets people to start over. So if you have $200,000 in debt and you're stuck and you really go through the bankruptcy filings, but Joe Biden voted to say you can't back in 2005. So just revoke that. Just take that out of the bankruptcy bill and let kids who are overwhelmed with debt go through the bankruptcy courts like anybody else would. And that the problem is, another problem is, we have, like I mentioned before, we have absolutely no financial education in this country. These kids, no one teaches them anything. They learn about 32 genders, but they don't learn how to do math. They don't learn about a checkbook. They don't learn about contracts. So they go to college or they turn 17 or 18 and they get all these letters, and suddenly, you know, somebody's offering them, $20,000 loan to go to college. And they're like, oh, okay, sounds great. Cause they have no concept of interest or, contracts or anything. And it's not right. And I think that the predatory class in this country, which is the financialization of everything, they love that, you know, they take advantage of it. So these kids are, I'm not blaming the kids that get in these debts, but there's a whole system set up to get them into debt. And in fact, that's really what our country is about now, is getting people into debt. It's been that way forever. Right. At least in the last 40 years. It's really exploded.
Yeah. Well, that really rung home to me when we were I'm an anti-debt guy. So I owe a little bit on my house because it's financed 275. I owe a little bit on a car because they gave me 1%. And other than that, no credit cards, nothing. You know, I'm anti-debt.
Yeah.
But my wife and I were refiing our house 2018, I want to say, somewhere around there. And we've got obviously good credit because we don't have a lot of debt. But in order to get the absolute best rate, we were informed that we needed to go open some additional credit cards because what was holding us down, we were barely below that prime, you know, that best rate. What was holding us down is we didn't have enough debt. And I remember hearing, I saw that and I went, huh. And it kind of spun along, you know, a long line of thinking of looking around going, this whole system is designed to funnel you into more debt. You know what I mean? Like it's every door you open, that's where it's leading to. We'll give you better financing if you just open more, right? You need more debt, man. It's a mind blower, you know? But then you realize it. And I think I think another good thing for the folks, if you want to realize this, right? A kid that doesn't know any better, that gets involved in $150,000 to $200,000 debt that he signed up for when he was 18, he can't include that in bankruptcy. But a billionaire can include, you know, mansions, private jets, Lamborghinis. You can include all that in bankruptcy. Just the poor schmuck that got $200,000 in debt. I just talk about a tilted system, right?
I think we should allow them to discharge in bankruptcy, 100%, and have to show that they can't pay it. That's fine. America lets you start over. Okay, that's why we have the bankruptcy laws. The forgiveness thing, it would end up being a forgiveness in effect too, but at least they would go through the process that we've had in this country for a couple hundred years instead of just Joe Biden
or even
throwing out ideas.
Yeah, or even like a half measure. Like, well, what if we can – what if they qualify? We can put them in a refinance that charges them like, you know, 0.8%. You know what I mean? Some very, very modestly – you know, you – there's
sure.
all kinds of
sure.
stuff that you could do to make this less onerous.
Right. Well, that's the thing I rail about all the time. I mean, they, you know, the hedge funds and stuff are borrowing at, you know, 0.75% and stuff from these Fed programs in March 2020, but the student loans were paying, what, 7% or something like that. I mean, it's the whole system is not designed to care about poor people or middle class people. It's all designed to care about the top 1%, frankly. I mean, to me, that's obvious. That's not even debatable. But yeah, I still get some people sometimes that say, no, but you know,
we've seen a lot of odd changes. It's been fascinating in my lifetime though, to watch how the political side swing. You know, it's just amazing. And look, there's plenty of this on both sides of the aisle. I'm not a partisan in any traditional sense whatsoever.
I loathe both
exactly,
parties. Yes.
Exactly. But it has been fascinating to watch some of these things flip. You know, like the Democrat Party, when I was a kid, they would have been raging against that bankruptcy law about student loans. They would have been raging about some of these things and inequality. And now they seem to be the ones that are the standard bearers. And like I said, there's plenty of people on the right, too. It just, you know, the same thing with the left that I grew up with was anti-war, make love not, you know, make peace not war, make love not war, all that kind of stuff. They're warmongers now. It's just been fascinating to watch this flip over.
That's a particularly galling thing to see the Democratic. I mean, even the progressive, the quote unquote progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Remember, they sent Biden a letter a couple of years ago, probably a year ago, asking him to negotiate a very polite kind of with Ukraine and Russia. In other words, stop the pointless slaughter. And they had to walk that back. They had to withdraw the letter because even the progressive Democrats are too wimpy to oppose, you know, funding unnecessary.
That's
deaths,
crazy.
You know?
I know.
It's crazy.
It's just bizarre.
I wanted to say about there's the explosion of debt. I mean, I call it the financialization of everything, which we've seen started in the 80s. And of course, exploded, I think, in the last 15 years, it really has, because when they take rates to zero, you know, as Jim Grant says, the problem with 5% rates is the decade of 0% rates that preceded it.
Yeah.
You know, the people went insane. The Fed went insane. All the central banks went insane during the 2010s. But there's actually something Elizabeth Warren, who I think is now, I think she's a phony, but she did say something good back in 2010. There's these things called the FCIC testimony, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which if anyone ever was bored, they have a whole bunch of interviews from very famous people talking about the GFC. So, but one thing, I listened to her testimony years ago and it was actually quite good. And she talks about how they took out the usury laws in the 80s, around 1980. They deregulated. But then, and this is something that I've seen a lot, what they did was that the consumer finance industry figured out that it's a better business model. She said the way she puts it, screening customers carefully and only lend to those to whom you have a fair amount of confidence will be able to repay. She said that was the old way. The new system, a far more profitable model of lend widely and in large amounts and reap large short-term profits from people who have only a marginal capacity to repay. And I think that really sums up. They started figuring out they could make mm-hmm. more money on poor people or middle-class struggling people than even on the rich people. You know, Steve, in The Big Short, there's a great anecdote about Steve Eisenman. I think it was Household Finance, where the line is, turn off your tape recorders. And the head of, I think it was Household Finance, explains that the purpose of free checking is basically gouge poor people with fees. You know, and Eisenman has a revelation where he says to himself, you know, I then realized that what consumer finance was just about screwing poor
yeah.
people. And that's just exploded. And now we screw middle class and upper middle class people too. But I mean, these guys are sharks, you know. there's a great anecdote. There was when Diamond was at Sandy Weill before J.P. Morgan,
Citibank, right?
And they're, I think, yeah. Well, before that, it might have even been Shearson or something. I don't know, but they, or I have,
Travelers.
I have
posted, maybe it was Travelers. All,
it could have been, but apparently there's a line. I think Alexander Cockburn wrote this piece, but it was he's talking. A secretary is listening to Weill and Diamond talk about consumer finance, and apparently the secretary who's listening chimes in and goes, you guys are just loan sharks. Consumer finance is a fancy way of putting it. So I think that's what we've got. We've got a massive, very powerful, very wealthy loan shark, you know, industry in the United States, up there with the money laundering industry.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Big one. But anyway.
One thing I want to talk about, a little bit of a switch of pace here, but it's been fascinating for me to watch. And I think that the last year and a half to 2 years has been a big learning. It's taught me a lot. And it's brought me to Chase Taylor and I, you know Chase, our Pinecone Mac.
Yeah.
He and I have been talking about this a lot lately. And we've been walking this direction for several years. I know we're not the only ones. I know this isn't going to be a surprise to you. But looking at the relationship between liquidity and rates, and in our opinion, I think it illuminates more ridiculousness from the Fed in the way that they view liquidity and rates as being so different. And I think the last couple of years, especially the last year, I think proves this, that if rates are effective in slowing down an economy, which I think that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that is the case, I think the reason that they're effective is because they soak up liquidity, right? So if you're pumping the rates and pumping the liquidity at the same time, the analogy I've used is like brushing your teeth and eating Oreos at the same time, right? You're undoing it as fast as you're doing it. And the theory that we were looking at last year was, hey, if we're correct that the main efficacy, if you will, of monetary policy, specifically interest rate policy, if the main efficacy is the fact that rates soak up liquidity, then we would expect the BTFP, regardless of where the policy rate is, we would expect the BTFP, the massive increase in Social Security last year, all those different inflows to swamp out the rates. And we think that they by doing this, they might just well reaccelerate inflation again. Well, here we are. What is your view on that interplay between interest rates, liquidity? Do you agree with us that maybe the main utility of interest rate increases that it soaks up liquidity? Or do you believe it as being, or do you see it as being different? I mean, I'm assuming you probably wouldn't agree with the way the Fed, I just think it's a classic Fed situation where they're like, well, that's liquidity, it's not interest rates. And you're looking at them going, what are you talking about? What is your take on that liquidity and interest rate interplay?
Well, I've said before, you know, if you go back as far as the data goes, you know, the Fed data, you know, the average Fed funds rate in the last 60 plus years is around 5%. I mean, people say rates are sky high now. No, the rates are normal. Remember, for the last 10 years, everyone's been talking about normalizing, or even more, 15 years, normalizing. Well, we finally normalized. So I'm not screaming for 8 or 10% rates. I, in my opinion, the QE has been, you know, and I have plenty of agreement with this from guys like Druckenmiller and others, you know, that QE was the biggest exacerbator of wealth inequality. And that's where the problem is. And particularly the mortgage-backed securities, which they owned zero in 2008, and they still now, with our booming greatest economy ever, $2.4 trillion of MBS. They had no business getting involved in the mortgage market. And Randy Woodward, who's a great guy on Twitter and knows a lot about, way more than I do, about banking. And he was commenting on, you know, why was the heat during the, you know, during March 2020 or whatever, why is the Fed buying MBS? And he didn't see a reason. He said, yeah, the prices were dropping, but there were buyers. So the Fed, he thought the Fed was saving somebody, possibly in Europe. And if you know anything about the history of this Federal Reserve, they oftentimes are way more interested in saving banks in other countries, it seems, than saving, you know, Joe Sixpack. Mm-hmm. But right now, $2.4 trillion. What would mortgage rates be if, you know, if the Fed didn't own $2.4 trillion? Of MBS. So I think they've presumably permanently distorted the mortgage market in this country, and therefore the housing market, which is, you know, the cause of all sorts of societal woes. You know, that the fact that you and I, when we were young, probably never doubted that we'd be able to afford a house, but plenty of kids now who, and by kids, I mean, you know, anyone younger than me, so 30-year-olds that with good jobs, they think they're never going to be able to buy because a starter house is $1 million. It's at least in some areas, it's absurd. As far as liquidity, you know, I just listened to Michael Howell, and you know, most of this stuff's way over my head, but he explains how basically he thinks they've been pumping liquidity. In other words, even though the Fed balance sheet, which is what I primarily look at because I'm a caveman, even though that's been moderately declining for a couple years now or a year, he says through their other programs, you know, it's been going up, and he thinks they're going to reverse. They're going to have to reverse, have to quote in quotes, his words, reverse the QT soon at some point. And whereas Dina Martino Booth, her opinion, I just heard her too, was I think that they may let the keep the MBS rolling off, but you know that's at a trickle, so it's really not affecting anything. They're doing, like you said, they're adding, you know, they're draining the pool and they got the hose pouring into the pool.
Here's the other thing, and I've spent a lot of time, we've spent a lot of time looking into this and working on this, and I think it is nonsense to refer to letting assets roll off the balance sheet as tightening. I think selling assets into the market, right? If quantitative easing is you going in basically into, now they're buying them from member banks. I understand that, but those banks are operating in the market, right? So they're effectively buying them out of the market, right? They're taking that supply off the offline.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at I'm looking at the Fed holdings of mortgage-backed securities. So like in November, they had 2.462, and now they have 2.417. So what, about $50 billion? They bought in November, December, January, February. They're 3 months. In 3 months, they've rolled off $50 billion. They bought in just 2 months. They bought $500 billion of MBS in 2020. Jeez. I mean, they went insane. There's no equilibrium or whatever the term is. They went insane. But first in 08, 09, and then in 2020, they really went insane. And that was all on Powell's watch. You know, I thought no one could be crazier than Bernanke and Yellen. But, you know, Powell went nuts before he found religion and decided to be, you know, I don't buy that he's Paul Volcker, but that was all on him. So,
well, yeah.
Anyway, they're not draining it nearly at the rate that they were, pumping everything.
Well, and think about it, right? Like, so – a bond rolling off isn't the same as selling one, meaning a bond rolling off does not increase supply and put downward pressure on price, right? Okay. So, but when they're going in there bidding it, it is putting upward pressure on price. And that's why I have a hard time with these definitions that the inverse of quantitative easing is letting bonds roll off the books. That isn't. Right. It doesn't have the same market impact, especially when they're standing there. And at any moment, we all know the minute the bond market blinks, they're going to start buying again. Right. So
I think
they have to. Right. They're married to this. Yeah. Right. I mean,
well, there's a whole supply demand issue. You know, they got a ton of supply coming. And right. And, you know, if not tomorrow, within our lifetimes, there's a hell of a lot of, there's a tsunami of supply.
Yeah. There's no way out of that. I mean, that's just a math.
And if the real world inflation of us is 10% or 15%, they're going to say it's 3 or 4, which gets back to the thing of what you mentioned to me earlier before this call that, you know, about they're going to try and raise the target up, from 2%. Which I think they will. I mean, people have been talking about this already for years, I think. You know, there is no 2% target. They pulled that out of the same place that TARP number came from, which is the, you know, to be nice, the air. Apparently some central banker in New Zealand, you know, years ago pulled 2% out, and Powell explains it based on their goofy inflation expectations theory of prices, which I guess sounds good to economists, but I don't think it makes much sense to normal people. But we've had a couple of my favorites lately that I posted. Bill Ackman 2 years ago, November 2022. He says we'll have to ultimately accept a higher level of inflation. That's Bill Ackman, who owns a ton of levered assets. So that's what I'd expect. And then this is a good one. This is Barry Sternlicht, one of my favorites. I think the number 2% is kind of arbitrary, Sternlicht told Fortune. And it could be 3% or 4%. That would be fine. And then the next sentence, this is from Fortune. Sternlicht, who boasts a net worth of $4.7 billion, believes that inflation isn't the boogeyman that many economists make it out to be. Well, there's so much wrong with that just one particular paragraph. I mean, first of all, economists do not think of inflation as a boogeyman. Economists like inflation. And in fact, for years, you know, Yellen's only regret as Fed chair, low inflation. That's a CNBC headline that I can send anybody who's interested. OK, and even Powell, low inflation is one of the major challenges of our time. He said this like within our lifetimes. This was like a few years ago. And I have every Fed chair or every Fed mucky muck saying we need higher inflation. Brainard wants a new normal, calls for higher inflation. All these guys. So first of all, Sternlicht saying that economists don't think inflation is a boogeyman is nonsense. And I mean, maybe there's a couple, but they're not on the Fed. And then, my other joke is, if you're worth $4.7 billion, you don't worry much about the cost of living, right? I mean, I just want to throttle these guys, you know. And I've listened to Sternlicht. He did an interview the other day with, I think, some podcast, and he actually sounded fairly reasonable, you know. And he wasn't crying for a bailout, probably because he wasn't on CNBC, because that's where they go to cry for their bailouts. But, basically he took a bet on low rates forever and it's not working out. And he bought up thousands and thousands and thousands of single family homes. So your kids and my kids can't buy them. And now he wants a bailout. They all want bailouts, you know. Anyway, the Economist wrote some good article. These are several years old, you know. The temptation now is to find another way out. Ditch the 2% inflation targets of recent decades and raise them modestly to say 4%. That is likely to be on the menu when the Fed begins its next strategy review in 2024. So they're saying a doubling of your cost of living, intentional, is modest. And even Bernanke, I love finding clips that just put in a nutshell what I'm saying. Bernanke in, 2012 or something, you know, or 2010, 28 maybe, inflation is a tax and it's too high. And, you know, inflation CPI was 2% when he said that. And he's talking to Ron Paul. It's a tax and it's a very regressive tax that's affecting poor people. And there in a nutshell is why you're seeing a disconnect between what the talking heads in the financial industry are saying and what the guy on the street is saying. And hopefully the voter is saying, I mean, you know, unfortunately, we reelect 99% of incumbents. Let's vote all these guys. I don't care what party.
Yeah.
I mean, write in somebody.
We need to add like an E, right? Like an all of the above, right? Just like, so we can just sit there and go, what are you voting for? I'm just voting for throw them all out, right? I want to start fresh.
I have an idea. You have a none of the above. Right. And then if that gets a plurality of votes, then you have a new election and none of the other candidates can run. none of the existing candidates. That'd be great.
That's a candidate. That's a candidacy I can get behind, my friend.
Yeah, but it might require some sort of constitutional change. And I don't think that's the last thing I want is a constitutional convention with this crowd. Can you imagine repealing the entire Bill of Rights?
We'd never even be able to agree on what a man or a woman is. You know what I mean? We were saying something the other day, and I was reminded of this, listening to what you were saying, and I'd like to hear your comments, but I'm sure you can identify with this. Guys out there saying the kind of stuff that we're saying, you get those occasional shots. Oh, what would you do? You know it better. You know, and they come at you like you're. I made this point on the Dots the other day where I said, look, I'm not saying I'm smarter. I'm not saying I know better. Our point in saying we had Steve Mirren on the show about a year ago, and we were having this conversation about what we thought the Fed was making a policy mistake by continuing to raise and not addressing liquidity. And what we were talking about was we were saying that if they keep pumping liquidity, they're risking reigniting inflation. And we were looking at the wave of commercial real estate that was coming up for refi in 2024. And the point we were making at the time was they're running the risk of needing to hike into a massive commercial real estate default cycle. They're being short-sighted and stupid. Fast forward a year, here we are, right?
And I well, reignite.
Well, no, go it, ahead. Well, it go never ahead. Really went away, right? But I do think they were making progress, and then they undid it. And when I say that, I want people to understand. We're not saying, oh, we were right and they were wrong, and we're smart and they're stupid. It was more of a hey, the fact that two guys sitting in Tacoma, Washington, and you've done the same thing, and many others said, hey, this is a problem. You could do this. It's terrifying to me that we were right. Right. Like, I'm not spiking the football and trying to extol my own brilliance. It's terrifying to me that the shaman of the economy 100%. Were wrong. And two schmucks sitting here that went to state school, we had it right. That's terrifying.
100%. I've said before, I'd rather live in a world where my jokes made no sense. Right. And I can't tell you how many times I've made a joke, like Powell says something or yelling, and then it comes true. Right. The latest one was, Powell, I put out these, like headlines, kind of like the real ones. Like Powell says, the Fed is prepared to change how CPI is calculated. And then, of course, sure enough, it's like it's too easy. I wish it wasn't that easy. And I get people sometimes say, yeah, we need guillotines and all that. And I'm like, I'm not into that at all. Because the problem is the wrong people will get blamed. Yep. It always happens. Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, Powell, Summers, Rubin, Biden, Trump, they're going to be fabulously wealthy, and they're never going to face any consequences for anything they've done.
No.
It's going to be on everybody else, and Larry Fink's going to be fine, and Bill Ackman's going to be fine. And Barry Sternlicht, even if, rates go to 10% and he loses all his businesses, he'll still be a billionaire. So, but their policies are really hurting a lot of people. Inflation. I mean, I've talked to death about inflation. Go to my Substack and I have free posts explaining the problem. It's really good for highly leveraged asset holders, generally. But even if you're someone say, your mortgage payment is okay. So fine. Let's say inflation is 10%. Your mortgage theoretically is being depreciated by that amount every year. So it's a little easier for you to pay. Well, first of all, that assumes that forgets that your insurance went up 40%. It forgets that a new roof now costs double what it used to. It forgets all these other things that kind of more than overwhelm the effect of inflation on your mortgage debt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's another thing they like to throw out is, people, hey, how much is your credit card debt? It's just 20 grand. And then, so at 5% inflation, that'll only feel like, 19 grand or whatever,
And you're like, in a classroom and on an Excel spreadsheet, man. That's not real life.
My pay didn't go up and I still owe the money plus interest, the 25% interest so they say all sorts of things that people accept as gospel on CNBC. Now, the guy in the street's not going to accept it as gospel, but nobody interviews the guy in the street. It's like, let's bring on Larry Summers to talk about the middle class. And that's a true statement. I mean, Davos had a panel years ago on the middle class, how what we need to do to help the middle class. And the panel was like Ray Dalio and Christine Lagarde and Larry Summers. I mean, there's nobody on this panel that's remotely ever even met probably a middle class person or a poor person. It's hilarious. And you got to look at the same people every day, the Leesmans and the Timoros and, Hilson Rath and all the rest of them. I mean, these guys are Fed cheerleaders. They're not.
And they're looking at you going, that's not true. I know tons of middle class. My attorneys are middle class, right? They are members of my club. They're middle class, right? They don't have private jets.
Yeah. I've said before, if you make $500,000 a year and you're worth seven figures or something, you're still closer to the homeless person than you are to David.
100%.
I mean? Yeah. I mean, they're just in a different world, and they control the politicians and they control the policies, and people, come out and pretend. I mean, our politicians are just terrible, which I say vote them all out, but people never do. They just, I like my guy.
It's better than their guy and the back and forth game and right, all that nonsense.
So nothing will ever change.
Closing this up, the kind of the last thing that I wanted to look at, two things. We've been talking about this a lot. Two things I want to get your opinion on. When I look at the world today, and this is probably not going to come to a surprise to anybody. People are going to be like, oh yeah, nice observation, man. But I do think that we have we probably crossed it years ago, truthfully, but it's certainly now, I think it's undeniable that I think that the days, right? People are like, how do we get this back? Or, you know, how do we get, and you're like, no. There is no going back, right? The numbers have gotten way too large. And our view on it now is that the Fed really does have a tiger by the tail. I think that they have jiggered with this so much and the constant intervention so much that if they tried to take a posture more like they did 20 years ago, where let markets sort it out, I think that we'd have a massive collapse on our hands. I don't think that the economies can function without the and I think it's not even really controversial to say that. Let's just go look at the frequency of which direct intervention from the Fed occurred prior to 08-09 versus how often it happens now. It, you know, BTFP was launched last year, $350 billion. It didn't even make the nightly news. It was one third of TARP, right? It didn't even make the news. So my question is this, is I think, and there will be bouts and there will be periods of turmoil, but I think the days of it for now, and I don't know how much longer it lasts, but I think the days of big crashes are over. I don't think they're going to allow it. I don't think that they can. I think the only way you look at this thing, right, there's two ways to deal with debt, pay off the debt or increase equity, right? So I think they've only got one way out. I think they're holding the tiger by the tail. Where are you at on that?
Well, that certainly is the narrative that somebody who's benefited, and I'm not talking about you directly, but I mean, someone who's benefited from all this intervention would say, you know, about half Americans don't even own any stocks in any form, you know, roughly. The ones that do that, I mean, like I said, the top 1% alone owns 50%. Although they've been changing the numbers to make it look better. I don't know. First of all, the question is the assumption that the Fed is omnipotent and can stop any crash. There's an interesting comment from Michael Howell about 1987, where he was walking in the pits back then. And he said that one of the traders told him after getting off a phone call, that was the Fed buying futures. This is 1987, wow. And I posted this. This is Michael Howell, so either Michael Howell is not telling the truth, or the trader was not telling the truth, or the Fed was intervening in the SPX in 1987. So I have no doubt. I mean, even Yellen, I think, has exploded the balloon a few years ago that the Fed should buy stocks. I mean, at that point, you're just kind of reaching, I don't know, fascism. I think it's not communism and it's not capitalism. Sort of a big business, mm-hmm. big government partnership. Ben Hunt talks about stocks as a utility mm-hmm. now, you know, that the government utility. That's not a free market. And the problem is we're going to lose, our growth, if you look like the last 30 years compared to the 30 years before. I mean, there's a variety of factors, but the more debt you have, we're at the point where, as Lacey Hunt, my favorite deflationist, likes to point out, that, you know, every $1, you know, it's like at some point, federal spending, it's a negative. You know, they spend a dollar, you lose 20 cents or something. It's so we're well past the point. And it's not productive debt. I mean, we have deteriorating roads. We're, you know, I guess we're building roads in Ukraine to replace the ones we built in Afghanistan. Absolutely. But this idea that, oh, well, I guess we, that's my joke. Oh, well, I guess we just have to bail out the billionaires again or the ATMs won't work. Well, maybe we should think about not bailing out the billionaires and think more just about backstopping, you know, make sure that that there aren't bank runs. I can understand that. But you know what? Those guys at Silicon Valley, they should have taken a big haircut. They were all big boys. They knew about the 250 limit. They're just connected. Now, what the average American listening to this needs to do is to hire a better lobbyist. Okay, so everyone go out and get a good lobbyist because – these guys have good lobbyists. I mean, I'm sure Bill Ackman was on the phone, you know, calling Yellen, calling Powell. And people see this and then they're like, well, gee, why is there the populism? I mean, people saw it in 08, you know, and we see it in 2020. You know, I have running jokes about Leon Cooperman coming on asking for a bailout, you know, people like that. You only see them show up when they're losing. You remember Hell is Coming from Bill Ackman back in 2020. And then he comes on like a month later and goes, I made $2.9 billion on the trade, you know, on the bounce. And it's like, I know most people are too busy trying to survive to have CNBC on in the background as white noise, but it's irritating. And I think it bugs people. And,
it does.
They got to be careful. No,
and when I say that, I'm with you 100%, meaning like like the way I view it is, look, guys, it's just I think it's true in economics. I think it's true in life. Let's take the medicine. Take the bloody medicine. Let's get it over with, because the longer we push it off, the worse it gets. Take the medicine and let's move on. I'm just saying that we live in a world where the medicine is not going to be tolerated.
Well, I'm hearing a lot lately. Well, you know, they're going to choose. They don't want to default. They don't want to default on the debt or on Social Security. So they're going to use inflation. They're just going to, you know, so instead of saying I can't pay you $100, I'm only going to pay you $50. They're going to pay you $100, but it's only going to buy you $50 worth of goods. And that is a default. It's a stealth default. They're defaulting differently, and it's a more dishonest default. It would be better if they came up and said, hey, all of the guys the last 30, 40 years have really blown it. We have to take haircuts, you know? Maybe when did Steve Bannon get kicked out of the White House? It wasn't for any, you know, politically incorrect thing he said. It was because he suggested like a 55% tax on incomes over $5 million. You know, so that's the third rail. You cannot suggest that a guy who benefits immensely from our global empire, like Ackman or Gates or Bloomberg, should pay. I mean, they benefited from the system. I mean, QE was the greatest, you know, thing that boosted their balance sheets. And so maybe they should pay more, you know? Unfortunately, what happens is you'll get someone like Elizabeth Warren come out saying, we're going to have a wealth tax, and it's only going to affect people with over $1 billion. And then, you know, within 4 years, it's affecting people that are worth more than $50,000. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. That's how it works. So Randy Waldman has a great—
I'll just say, as a small business owner, right, they look at your business and they go, you're wealthy. And you go, whoa, hold on a second. Right. Yeah. You're not counterbalancing this with the ever present risk that I am taking every single day. Right. All that cash you see sitting there, I can't go spend that. That's called capital reserves. Right. You're trying to tax me and that's the problem. Right. They end up throwing the small business guy in with the quote unquote wealthy. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. Billionaires use make human shields of the merely affluent. That's a great line from a guy Stephen Waldman. But yeah, that's a lot of the guys I talk to. They're small business guys, and you know, they're of course their costs are way up, I'm very pro capitalist. You know, I like the guy that has a pizza business or has the hardware store. And I see something like Citigroup or, you know, J.P. Morgan, which I think is just a fascist partnership of big business and big government. And unfortunately, that's where all the attention has been probably forever. But I mean, particularly more so, you know, the policies of the Fed have these guys were going to get rich no matter what. But the ZIRP for 10 years and then all of the bailout programs, you know, it's massively distorted the lower 95% on the top few percent. I mean, I was looking, remember all those programs they set up in March 2020? And I did this after 2008 too. All the TALF and SCMPF or whatever, they had all these programs. And I'm looking at I actually went and looked on the Fed website and looked at the Excel spreadsheets. And I posted some of this. And it's like, these are all these LLCs set up in the Cayman Islands a month ago. And that are getting like $100-200 million loans at like 0.75%. And I posted this back in 2020. And again, why am I doing this? Other than a guy like Matt Taibbi or someone like that, nobody in our financial press, very few, look into this stuff. And it's obscene. And if there was a politician who went on TV and showed, hey, who is this LLC in Barbados that got this $200 million at 0.75? Did you get a loan at 0.75? And that would fire people up and like get them motivated. We need a candidate like that. But there isn't one. It's just like I've said before about the Epstein thing. Why is there no – I said this in 2020, sorry. Why is there no candidate saying, hey, guys, we have a huge section of our elite that was tied at the hip to this, you know, serial sex trafficker? Nobody did it. No, I'm not aware of any politician really that brought it up. And I think it's because it's so bipartisan, or everyone's got a, being blackmailed or something. I mean, there's no other explanation for it because it would get people fired up. And if there was a politician who just took random posts from my Twitter feed and put them in a speech and gave it, I think people would be like outraged, like, because most people have no, you and I know what's going on. Well, we know a little bit of what's going on, but most people have absolutely no clue. They don't understand. They don't know anything about hedonics. They don't know anything about CPI. I bet you most people, I'm 100% convinced, most people think you take a basket of goods and you take the price of all of them in this year, and then you compare it to the price next year, and that's the CPI. That's the inflation rate. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I think you just explain that one simple thing to people, they'll be fired up.
No, I agree with you.
But nobody knows.
One last thought for you, something that we've been thinking about lately. We're looking at a situation right now, and you know, we'll have to see the way it plays out. But I think that you have the groundwork set. I think that Goolsbee was out there talking about it yesterday. You and I.
He blocked me.
Oh, did he?
He's the only Fed official that has ever, to my knowledge, blocked me. I'm sure I'm muted by some. Yeah. No, he blocked
me. You know what, though, man? I feel like we ought to buy you. The trophy ought to come with that. Or like a jacket or something.
I'm blocked by some great people.
Yeah, you really are. If you judge a man by the caliber of his enemies, you're right up there at the top, pal.
Absolutely.
So one thing we were talking about, and I want people to understand that this is not what I'm cheering for. This is not what I'm hoping for. I don't even know if I think this is a probability, but my job is to sit back and assess, you know, all the different probabilities and, you know, pay attention and, you know, see where it goes. So when we were looking at this current setup and looking at the idea that despite our thrashings and screaming about it a year ago, here we are in a situation where we've got reaccelerating inflation that never really went away, like you and I were discussing, but reaccelerating. And we've got some really saucy issues coming down the pipe by ways of what's going on with commercial real estate refis and all that kind of stuff. And you're looking at a real life scenario now where if I had to bet dollars to cents, I think that we're going to cut this year. I'll be surprised if they only cut once. We're going to be cutting into a hot market or hot inflation. The last time, and I know I'll be shocked if you don't know this. Are you aware of the last time the Fed cut into an economy that was supposedly growing at this rate, that had unemployment rates close to this? Are you aware of the last time that happened?
What was it? Was it Y2K?
Late 98, right after long-term capital.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Long-term. Yeah, that was another – yeah, that was a bailout.
What was interesting, we look back. You know what the Fed funds rate was right when long-term capital blew up? 5.5.
Was it five? What was it?
Just like it is right
now.
5.5,
yeah.
So they had to cut, and we all know what happened in the subsequent 13, 14 months. NASDAQ went up 103%. I'm looking at that right now and going – Like I said, I'm not predicting that's going to happen. I don't want it to happen at all. But I can't help but look at the action of this market, how unfundamentally tethered it is, still looking at the bullishness and the animal spirits out there, and then thinking about the Fed throwing a rate cut or two at this. Have you thought about that? And if so, what do you think the likelihood that these schmucks have engineered potentially another 1999 blow off top, and people go, "What's wrong with that?" And you go, "Guys, it's what happens afterwards." Right.
It's It's when asset bubbles pop that bad things happen.
Because good players pulled down with bad ones when that happens.
That's right. You sell what you can. And Druckenmiller has a great line where he says, "You know, we've never had a depressionary event because rates were 1% or 1.5%. We've had them because of the asset bubbles." In other words, the asset bubble popping, Grantham says this too. And of course, you mentioned Grantham. Someone says, "Oh, he's a perma bear," but you know, these guys are smart, and you have to try and avoid the major crashes when they come. And this will be we had in my lifetime. You know, I mean, I wasn't really involved in 73, 74, but when it went down 50%, but you know, we had 87 was a blip. But the 2000 to 2003 period, and then of course the 07 or to 09 period, we lost 50% on the SPX, you know, even during those times. Okay. Go look at the NASDAQ. I think the NASDAQ was down even way more than that and I have charts on all this. I just can't remember everything. Absolutely. I think about this. I think, you know, we went up like you said, I think we went up 80% in 4 months or something in the end of 99, just melted up.
It was 103, I believe, in the year for the NASDAQ.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And then it went down like 80% or something, NASDAQ. Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. We could have a blow off, you know, people, because of my glass half full sort of, constitution, people think that I'm like I'm short or something. I always get, you know, I used to get that more. I think people realize now I'm very long. Like everyone else, I'm going to sell at the top. you know, I have a very weird diversified, well, a sort of a barbell portfolio, but, no, I don't worry about it. I don't really watch the market that much. I do, it's always on, but I do very little trading. I just try and have you know, as Buffett said years ago, have holdings that you wouldn't mind if the market was closed for 10 right. years, you know, and I've done quite well at never owning the popular stocks. So, go figure. I haven't shorted since 2009. And, once in a while I joke that it was if I want to hedge against capital gains, I'll buy puts, but absolutely we could have a blow off top. And maybe it's not a top. I mean, you know, look at the Venezuela stock market or the Argentina yeah. stock market. It just, you know, these are choices that these guys are going to have to make, and they have painted us into such a corner, or themselves. But unfortunately, it's like we're on this ship that these guys have crashed, and we, you know, we got to help them bail it out. I don't know. I just wish we'd try capitalism maybe yeah. a little bit more. I haven't seen much of that in the last 10 years. I mean, you get it for the little guy. You just don't get it for the Sternlichs and Ackmans of the world, which, you know, and there's no accountability. I mean, we still have Larry Summers opining every day.
My God.
And that guy's track record alone since, I mean, this is like 30, 40 years. I mean, Yellen was at the Fed in the 1970s. I mean, aren't there any new young minds out there that can, you know, I guess economics now is so inbred that they're all messed up. And so we have a whole generation that's just lost of bad economic theory. These neo-Keynesians or whatever they are. I think Keynes would be shocked by where we're
at. And talk about a guy that's been done dirty by the right. Like he'd sit there and go, wait a second, you left out the whole run surpluses during growth periods, right?
Right. Well, they're bad economists, right. As Bastiat would describe. They don't consider the consequences of their actions. They think of the immediate effect. And the thing is, they're going to be fine. Janet Yellen's going to be fabulously wealthy the rest of her life. And Ben Bernanke is, I hear, you know, making $20 million a year or whatever. What do you think his bonus is? You know, when Citadel's making, you know, record billions in profits, you know. And that's another thing. It's how egregious is it that these, you know, Yellen gives $7 million in 2 years speeches to banks she formerly regulated, or Bernanke goes to Citadel and PIMCO. Everybody goes to PIMCO. You know, Kashkari went to PIMCO. Greenspan went to PIMCO. And then they have special deals. PIMCO has special deals with the Fed over the years. And so it's so incestuous, and no one in Congress cares. There's no Ron Paul anymore. And the populace is mostly just ignorant. And I don't mean that in a bad way. They don't know. And so that's why I'm saying, I wish there was a politician who would let them know. I mean, there's a couple obscure ones, but I mean, I don't know. I think it's because, you know, I mean, look at Trump, right? Trump wanted negative rates. Trump wanted more QE. So if you think Trump is the answer for monetary and policy or fiscal policy, I don't think it would be any, you know, as we know, it wouldn't be any better than what we have now. They all love to spend money. And I wish, and there's nothing wrong with spending money, but let's build a Hoover Dam. Let's not just hand it out
100%
to bank depositors who are billionaires at SVB.
And
whatever.
I think another easy way to look behind the curtain for the average person is this. Okay. You don't have to study this stuff really long to uncover the abysmal forecasting of the Fed, meaning they're the only people.
It's worse than mine.
They're the only people that make weathermen look accurate, right? And then to see these guys leave the FOMC and have an absolute – I had a buddy that worked for Griffin at Citadel. He just said, whatever you've heard, it's worse. He goes, the guy doesn't care. He will eat you alive. He doesn't care. He goes – he's fired a bunch of traders their first day. Like just, you know, just, he's just brutal. And I'm not saying that's all bad. Look, Ken Griffin has made he's a very smart, very, my point is this. When you consider that forecasting record, what is a guy like Griffin paying a guy like Bernanke $3 to $5 million a year for? It ain't for his ability to predict market moves, right? What's he buying, right? It's access. It's influence.
Yep.
It ain't for his brain or his ability to predict market moves.
Have you ever seen Yellen speak? Have you ever listened to her speak? She's the least charismatic person on earth. And they were paying her $300,000 or $250,000 for a Zoom call. I mean, it's outrageous, but we're just, you know, sometimes we're just like voices crying in the wilderness. Nobody in power cares. We need, you know, so first of all, you and I need to be, become billionaires, and then we need to hire some lobbyists, and then maybe we'll get the word out.
Well, we got to work on it. The only way we're going to get there, though, I think, is if we've got a couple politicians in our pocket. So, you know, maybe we got to start like a farm team or something. so we could start out small and own them when they get to the Senate, right? Otherwise, we're
gonna, let me know if you find
one. We're going to get bid out.
Yeah, I'm still voting. I'll still probably vote for Ron Paul in the 2024 election. Like I have a
number. You just wrote him in.
Whether he's on the ballot or not. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or Jim Grant. I've been joking for years. In fact, Jim Grant sent me an email one time saying, thank you for, I understand you're pushing me for president. So
he's a great guy.
That was nice because I followed Jim for forever. He's one of the greatest financial writers. And
I know, you know what? I got to make a push. I was thinking about it. We were bringing up Schiller, and I've had Schiller on the show before. Grant,
I would love
to get Grant. You know what? I'll reach out to him through Dimitri Kafinas. I know Dimitri knows him. I would love to get Jim on and just pick it. I grew up listening to Jim. I think my grandfather knew him, actually. Anyway, I'd love to get him on.
Yeah, or Charlie Grant, his son.
Oh, yeah, Charlie, yep.
He's on Twitter. Let's see. Yeah, C. Grant, WSJ.
I DM'd with them years ago and was trying to set something up. But, I'll follow back up a little bit.
Well, anyway, everybody vote for Jim Grant in the 2024 election.
Jim Grant for president.
Write him in.
All right, man. Sure, I cannot appreciate – I just can't say thank you enough for having you back on. Like I said, I saw this stuff rolling out this week, and I was like, there's one guy I got to get to have this discussion with. So appreciate it. The folks can follow you at Rudy Havenstein, right? Isn't that
– Yes.
And
yes.
Havenstein, Havenstein. Great follow.
Correct.
And then Substack. Where do they get yours? And, guys, if you're listening to this – Rudy really is an expert on this stuff. No, you are, in terms of understanding especially the interplay with, with the real economy and Fed, right? You may not be at a PhD economist level, but in terms of relaying that information to the common man and how it interplays with the normal economy.
I think I'm good at drawing connections between disparate things over time. Because people are always like, how did you able to find these things, and it's all keywords, but that's one thing. Other than that, no, I mean, if you're talking about the plumbing or something, of course you go to somebody like Joseph Wang, or you talk to Howell or someone like that. I'm just a novice on that kind of stuff, but I do see how these policies have evolved over the years and the effect they've had on the middle class in particular, which is where I came from. And that's why I'm particularly trying to be a fighter for them when no one else in the public sphere really is.
So you and me both.
I'm in my own tiny way. Yeah, Substack is rudy.substack.com.
Yep. All right, pal. Well, I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
And it's been fun as always. And we'll have to do it again. I think we're going to have plenty of stuff to talk about in the coming months and years.
Yeah. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I tend to do that.
No, I enjoyed it, man. And I hope you guys enjoyed it just as much as I did. Thank you so much for listening. As always, give us a subscribe. Rudy's good enough to come on, but it helps us get, you know, more guests on and all that kind of stuff. So, anyway, have a great weekend. We will be back with the dots on Monday. Talk to you then. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.